Chapter 12. I want to introduce a project, said Badap, from the Syndicate of Initiative. You know that we've been in radio contact with Urus for about 20 decades. Against the recommendation of this council and the defensive federative and a majority vote of the list. Yes, Badap said, looking the speaker up and down, but not protesting the interruption. There were no rules of parliamentary procedure at meetings in PDC. Interruptions were sometimes more frequent than statements. The process, compared to a well-managed executive conference, was a slab of raw beef compared to a winning diagram. Raw beef, however, functions better than a wiring diagram would in its place, inside a living animal. Badap knew all his old opponents on the Import-Export Council. He had been coming and fighting them for 3 years now. This speaker was a new one, a young man, probably a new lottery posting to the PDC list. Badap looked him over benevolently and went on. Let's not refight old quarrels, shall we? I propose a new one. We've received an interesting message from a group on Urus. It came on the wavelength our IATI contacts use, but it didn't come at a scheduled time and was a weak signal. It seems to have been sent from a country called Benbili, not from Aio. The group called themselves the Odonian Society. It appears that they're post-settlement Odonians, existing in some fashion in the loopholes of law and government on Urus. Their message was to the Brothers Onanaris. You can read it in the Syndicate Bulletin. It's interesting. They ask if they might be allowed to send people here. Send people here? Let Erasti come here? Spies? No. As settlers. They want the settlement reopened? Is that it, Badap? They say they're being hounded by their government and are hoping for reopen the settlement. To any profiteer who calls himself an Odonian? To report an Anaresti managerial debate in full would be difficult. It went very fast, several people often speaking at once, nobody speaking at great length, a good deal of sarcasm, a great deal left unsaid. The tone emotional, often fiercely personal. An end was reached, yet there was no conclusion. It was like an argument among brothers or among thoughts in an undecided mind. If we let these so-called Odonians come, how do they propose to get here? There spoke the opponent Badap dreaded, the cool, intelligent woman named Rulak. She had been his cleverest enemy all year in the council. He glanced at Shevik, who was attending this council for the first time, to draw his attention to her. Somebody had told Badap that Rulag was an engineer, and he had found in her the engineer's clarity and pragmatism of mind, plus the mechanist's hatred of complexity and irregularity. She opposed the Syndicate of Initiative on every issue, including that of its right to exist. Her arguments were good, and Badap respected her, sometimes when she spoke of the strength of Urus and the danger of bargaining with the strong from a position of weakness. He believed her. For there were times when Badap wondered, privately, whether he and Shevik, when they got together in the winter of 68, and discussed the means by which a frustrated physicist might print his work and communicate it to physicists on Urus, had not set off an uncontrollable chain of events. When they had finally set up radio contact, the Erasti had been more eager to talk, to exchange information, than they had expected. And when they had printed reports of those exchanges, the opposition on Onaris had been more virulent than they had expected. People on both worlds were paying more attention to them than was really comfortable. When the enemy enthusiastically embraces you and the fellow countrymen bitterly reject you, it's hard not to wonder if you are, in fact, a traitor. I suppose they'd come on one of the freighters, he replied. Like good Odonians, they'd hitchhike if their government or the Council of World Governments lets them. Would they let them? Would the archists do the anarchists a favor? That's what I'd like to find out. If we invited a small group, 6 or 8 of these people, what would happen at that end? Laudable curiosity, Rulag said. We'd know the danger better, all right, if we knew better how things really worked on Urus. But the danger lies in the act of finding out. She stood up, signifying that she wanted to hold the floor for more than a sentence or two. Badap winced and glanced again at Shivik, who sat beside him. Look out for this one, he muttered. Shivik made no response, but he was usually reserved and shy at meetings. No good at all, unless he got moved deeply by something, in which case he was a surprisingly good speaker. He sat looking down at his hands. But as Rulag spoke, Badap noticed that though she was addressing him, she kept glancing at Shivik. Your syndicate of initiative, she said, emphasizing the pronoun, has proceeded with building a transmitter, with broadcasting to Urus and receiving from them, and with publishing the communications. You've done all this against the advice of the majority of the PDC, and increasing protests from the entire Brotherhood. There have been no reprisals against your equipment or yourselves yet, largely, I believe, because we Odonians have become unused to the very idea of anyone's adopting a course harmful to others and persisting in it against advice and protest. It's a rare event. In fact, you are the first of us who have behaved in the way that archist critics always predicted people would behave, in a society without laws, with total irresponsibility towards the society's welfare. I don't propose to go again into the harm you've already done, the handing out of scientific information to a powerful enemy, the confession of our weakness that each of your broadcasts to Urus represents. But now, thinking that we've got used to all that, you're proposing something very much worse. What's the difference, you'll say, between talking to a few Arasti on the shortwave and talking to a few of them here in Abenai? What's the difference? What's the difference between a shut door and an open one? Let's open the door. That's what he's saying, you know, Amari. Let's open the door. Let the Arasti come. 6 or 8 pseudo-Odonians on the next freighter, 60 or 80 Iadi profiteers on the one after, to look us over and see how we can be divided up as a property among the nations of Urus. And the next trip will be 600 or 800 armed ships of war, guns, soldiers, and occupying force. The end of Anaris. The end of the promise. Our hope lies, it has lain for 170 years, in the terms of the settlement. No Urasti off the ships, except the settlers, then or ever. No mixing, no contact. To abandon that principle now is to say to the tyrants whom we defeated once, the experiment has failed. Come, re-enslave us. Not at all, Badap said promptly. The message is clear. The experiment has succeeded. We're strong enough now to face you as equals. The argument proceeded as before, a rapid hammering of issues. It did not last long. No vote was taken, as usual. Almost everyone present was strongly for sticking to the terms of the settlement. And as soon as this became clear, Badap said, All right, I'll take that as settled. Nobody comes in on the Kuyeo Fort or the Mindful. In the matter of bringing Urasti to Anaris, the Syndicate's aims clearly must yield to the opinion of the society as a whole. We asked your advice and will follow it. But there's another aspect of the same question. Shivik? Well, there's the question, Shivik said, of sending an Anaresti to Urus. There were exclamations and queries. Shivik did not raise his voice, which was not far above a mumble, but persisted. It wouldn't harm or threaten anyone living on Anaris, and it appears that it's a matter of the individual's right, a kind of test of it, in fact. The terms of the settlement don't forbid it. To forbid it now would be an assumption of authority by the PDC, an abridgment of the right of the Odonian individual to initiate action harmless to others. Rulag sat forward. She was smiling a little. Anyone can leave Anaris, she said. Her light eyes glanced from Shivik to Badap and back. He can go wherever he likes. If the Propertarian's freighters will take him, he can't come back. Who says he can't? Badap demanded. The terms of the closure of the settlement. Nobody will be allowed off the freighter ships farther than the boundary of the port of Inaris.
Well, now, that was surely meant to apply to Arasti, not Anaresti, said an old advisor, Ferdaz, who liked to stick his oar in even when it steered the boat off the course he wanted.
A person coming from Uras is an Arasti, said Rulak.
Legalisms, legalisms,
what's all this quibbling? Said a calm, heavy woman named Treppel.
Quibbling, cried the new member, the young man. He had a north rising accent and a deep, strong voice. If you don't like quibbling, try this. If there are people here that don't like Inaris, let them go. I'll help. I'll carry them to the port. I'll even kick them there. But if they try to come sneaking back, there's going to be some of us there to meet them, some real Odonians, and they won't find us smiling and saying, welcome home, brothers. They'll find their teeth knocked down their throats and their balls kicked up into their bellies. Do you understand that? Is it clear enough for you?
Clear, no. Plain, yes. Plain as a fart, said Badap. Clarity is a function of thought. You should learn some Odonianism before you speak here.
You're not worthy to say the name of Odo, the young man shouted. You're traitors, you and the whole syndicate. There are people all over Inaris watching you. You think we don't know that Shevik's been asked to go to Uris, to go sell Anaresti's science to the profiteers? You think we don't know that all you snivelers would love to go there and live rich and let the Propertarians pat you on the back? You can go. Good riddance. But if you try coming back here, you'll meet with justice.
He was on his feet and leaning across the table, shouting straight into Badap's face. Badap looked up at him and said, you don't mean justice. You mean punishment. Do you think they're the same thing?
He means violence, Rulag said. And if there is violence, you will have caused it. You and your syndicate, and you will have deserved it.
A thin, small, middle-aged man beside Treppel began speaking, at first so softly, in a voice hoarsened by the dust cough, that few of them heard him. He was a visiting delegate from a Southwest miners syndicate, not expected to speak on this matter.
What men deserve, he was saying, for we each of us deserve everything, every luxury that was ever piled in the tombs of the dead kings, and we each of us deserve nothing, not a mouthful of bread in hunger. Have we not eaten while another starved? Will you punish us for that? Will you reward us for the virtue of starving while others ate? No man earns punishment. No man earns reward. Free your mind of the idea of deserving, the idea of earning, and you will begin to be able to think.
They were, of course, Odo's words from the prison letters, but spoken in the weak, hoarse voice, they made a strange effect. As if the man were working them out word by word himself, as if they came from his own heart, slowly, with difficulty, as the water wells up slowly, slowly from the desert sand. Rulag listened, her head erect, her face set like that of a person repressing pain. Across the table from her, Shevik sat with his head bowed. The words left a silence after them. And he looked up and spoke into it. You see, he said, what we're after is to remind ourselves that we didn't come to Inaris for safety, but for freedom. If we must all agree, all work together, we're no better than a machine. If an individual can't work in solidarity with his fellows, it's his duty to work alone. His duty and his right. We have been denying people that right. We've been saying more and more often, you must work with the others. You must accept the rule of the majority. But any rule is tyranny. The duty of the individual is to accept no rule, to be the initiator of his own acts, to be responsible. Only if he does so will the society live and change and adapt and survive. We are not subjects of a state founded upon law, but members of a society founded upon revolution.
Revolution is our obligation, our hope of evolution. The revolution is in the individual spirit, or it is nowhere. It is for all, or it is nothing. If it is seen as having any end, it will never truly begin. We can't stop here. We must go on. We must take the risks. Rulag replied, as quietly as he, but very coldly. You have no right to involve us all in a risk that private motives compel you to take. No one who will not go as far as I'm willing to go has any right to stop me from going, Shevik answered. Their eyes met for a second. Both looked down. The risk of a trip to Urus involves nobody but the person going, Badap said. It changes nothing in the terms of the settlement and nothing in our relationship with Urus, except, perhaps, morally, to our advantage. But I don't think we're ready, any of us, to decide on it. I'll withdraw the topic for the present if it's agreeable to the rest of you. They assented, and he and Shevik left the meeting. I've got to go over to the Institute, Shevik said as they came out of the PDC building. Sabul sent me one of his toenail clippings, first in years. What's on his mind, I wonder? What's on that woman Rulag's mind, I wonder? She's got a personal grudge against you. Envy, I suppose. We won't put you two across a table again, or we'll get nowhere. Though that young fellow from North Rising was bad news, too. Majority rule and might makes right. Are we going to get our message across, Shev? Or are we only hardening the opposition to it? We may really have to send somebody off to Urus. Prove our right to by acts, if words won't do it. Maybe. So long as it isn't me. I'll talk myself purple about our right to leave Inaris, but if I had to do it, by damn, I'd slit my throat. Shevik laughed. I've got to go. I'll be home in an hour or so. Come eat with us tonight. I'll meet you at the room. Shevik set off down the street with his long stride. Badap stood hesitating in front of the PDC building. It was mid-afternoon, a windy, sunny, cold spring day. The streets of Abenai were bright, scoured-looking, alive with light and people. Badap felt both excited and let down. Everything, including his emotions, was promising yet unsatisfactory. He went off to the domicile in the Pekesh block, where Shevik and Takver now lived, and found, as he had hoped, Takver at home with the baby. Takver had miscarried twice, and then Pilon had come along later, and a little unexpected, but very welcome. She had been small at birth, and now, getting on to two, was still small, with thin arms and legs. When Badap held her, he was always vaguely frightened of, or repelled by, the feeling of those arms, so fragile that he could have broken them simply with a twist of his hand. He was very fond of Pilon, fascinated by her cloudy gray eyes and won by her utter trustfulness. But whenever he touched her, he knew consciously, as he had not done before, what the attraction of cruelty is, why the strong torment the weak. And therefore, though he could not have said why therefore, he also understood something that had never made much sense to him or interested him at all, parental feeling. It gave him a most extraordinary pleasure when Pilon called him Tade. He sat down on the bed platform under the window. It was a good-sized room with two platforms. The floor was matted. There was no other furniture, no chairs or tables, only a little movable fence that marked off a play space or screened Pilon's bed. Takver had the long, wide drawer of the other platform open, sorting piles of papers kept in it. "Do hold Pilon, dear Dap," she said with her large smile, when the baby began working towards him. "She's been into these papers at least 10 times, every time I get them sorted. I'll be done in just a minute here. 10 minutes. Don't hurry. I don't want to talk. I just want to sit here." "Come on, Pilon, walk. There's a girl. Walk to Tade Dap. Now I've got you." Pilon sat contentedly on his knees and studied his hand. Badap was ashamed of his nails,
which he no longer bit, but which remained deformed from biting, and at first he closed his hand to hide them. Then he was ashamed of shame and opened up his hand. Pillin patted it. "This is a nice room," he said. "With the north light, it's always calm in here."
"Yes, shh, I'm counting these."
After a while, she put the files of papers away and shut the drawer.
"There, sorry. I told Chev I'd page that article for him. How about a drink?"
Rationing was still in force on many staple foods, though much less strict than it had been 5 years before. The fruit orchards of North Rising had suffered less and recovered quicker from the drought than the grain-growing regions. And last year, dried fruits and fruit juices had gone off the restricted list. Tocqueville had a bottle standing in the shaded window. She poured them each a cupful, in rather lumpy earthenware cups, which Sadek had made at school. She sat down opposite Badap and looked at him, smiling.
"Well, how's it going at PDC?"
"Same as ever. How's the fish lab?" Tocqueville looked down into her cup, moving it to catch the light on the surface of the liquid.
"I don't know. I'm thinking of quitting."
"Why, Tocqueville?"
"Rather quit than to be told to. The trouble is, I like that job, and I'm good at it, and it's the only one like it in Abani. But you can't be a member of a research team that's decided you're not a member of it."
"They're coming down harder on you, are they?"
"All the time," she said,
and looked rapidly and unconsciously at the door, as if to be sure that Shevik was not there, hearing.
"Some of them are unbelievable. Well, you know. There's no use going on about it."
"No. That's why I'm glad to catch you alone."
"I don't really know. I and Shev and Skovan and Gizach and the rest of us who spend most of the time at the printing shop or the radio tower don't have postings, and so we don't see much of people outside the Syndicate of Initiative. I'm at PDC a lot, but that's a special situation. I expect opposition there because I create it. What is it that you run up against?"
"Hatred," Tocqueville said, in her dark, soft voice. "Real hatred. The director of my project won't speak to me anymore."
"Well, that's not much loss. He's a stick anyhow.
But some of the others do tell me what they think. There's a woman, not at the fish labs, here in the Dom. I'm on the block sanitation committee, and I had to go speak to her about something. She wouldn't let me talk."
"Don't you try to come into this room. I know you, you damned traitors, you intellectuals, you egoizers," and so on and so on, and then slammed the door. It was grotesque. Tocqueville laughed without humor. Pilon, seeing her laugh, smiled as she sat curled in the angle of Badap's arm, and then yawned.
"But you know, it was frightening. I'm a coward, Dap. I don't like violence. I don't even like disapproval."
"Of course not. The only security we have is our neighbor's approval. Anarchists can break a law and hope to get away unpunished, but you can't break a custom. It's the framework of your life with other people. We're only just beginning to feel what it's like to be revolutionaries, as Chev put it in the meeting today. And it isn't comfortable."
"Some people understand," Tocqueville said with determined optimism. "A woman on the omnibus yesterday, I don't know where I'd met her, 10th day work sometime, I suppose. She said, it must be wonderful to live with a great scientist. It must be so interesting. And I said, yes, at least there's always something to talk about." "Pilon, don't go to sleep, baby. Shevik will be home soon, and we'll go to Commons. Jiggler, Dap. Well, anyway, you see, she knew who Shev was, but she wasn't hateful or disapproving. She was very nice."
"People do know who he is," Badap said. "It's funny because they can't understand his books any more than I can. A few hundred do, he thinks. Those students in the divisional institutes who try to organize simultaneity courses. I think a few dozen would be a liberal estimate myself. And yet people know of him. They have this feeling he's something to be proud of. That's one thing the syndicate has done, I suppose, if nothing else. Printed Chev's books. It may be the only wise thing we've done."
"Oh, now, you must have had a bad session at PDC today."
"We did. I'd like to cheer you up, Tocqueville, but I can't. The syndicate is cutting awfully close to the basic societal bond, the fear of the stranger. There was a young fellow there today, openly threatening violent reprisal. Well, it's a poor option, but he'll find others ready to take it. And that Rulag, by damn, she's a formidable opponent.
You know who she is, Dap.
Who is she?
Chev never told you? Well, he doesn't talk about her. She's the mother.
Chev's mother?
Takfer nodded. She left when he was 2. The father stayed with him. Nothing unusual, of course, except Chev's feelings. He feels that he lost something essential. He and the father both. He doesn't make a general principle of it. That parents should always keep the children or anything, but the importance loyalty has for him. It goes back to that, I think.
What's unusual? Said Badap energetically, oblivious of Pilan, who had gone sound asleep on his lap.
Distinctly unusual is her feelings about him. She's been waiting for him to come to an import-export meeting. You could tell today. She knows he's the soul of the group, and she hates us because of him.
Why?
Guilt?
Has the Adonian society gone so rotten we're motivated by guilt?
You know? Now that I know it, they look alike.
Only in her, it's all gone hard, rock hard,
dead. The door opened as he was speaking. Shivik and Sadik came in. Sadik was 10 years old, tall for her age, and thin, all long legs, supple and fragile, with a cloud of dark hair. Behind her came Shivik, and Badap, looking at him in the curious new light of his kinship with Rulag, saw him as one occasionally sees a very old friend, with the vividness to which all the past contributes. The splendid, reticent face, full of life, but worn down, worn to the bone. It was an intensely individual face, and yet the features were not only like Rulag's, but like many others among the Anaresti, a people selected by a vision of freedom and adapted to a barren world, a world of distances, silences, desolations. In the room, meantime, much closeness, commotion, communion, greetings, laughter, Pilan being passed around, rather crossly on her part, to be hugged, the bottle being passed around to be poured, questions, conversations. Sadik was the center first, because she was the least often there of the family. Then Shivik.
What did old Greasy Beard want?
Were you at the Institute? Takfer asked, examining him as he sat beside her.
Just went by there. Sabu left me a note this morning at the Syndicate. Shivik drank off his fruit juice and lowered the cup, revealing a curious set to his mouth, a non-expression. He said the Physics Federation has a full-time posting to fill. Autonomous. Permanent.
For you mean? There, at the Institute?
He nodded.
Sabul told you?
He's trying to enlist you, Badap said.
Yes, I think so.
If you can't uproot it, domesticate it, as we used to say in North Setting. Shivik suddenly and spontaneously laughed.
It is funny, isn't it? He said.
No, said Takfer. It isn't funny, it's disgusting. How could you go talk to him, even? After all the slander he's spread about you and the lies about the principals being stolen from him, and not telling you that the Oresti gave you that prize, and then just last year, when he got those kids who organized the lecture series broken up and sent away because of your crypto-authoritarian influence over them? You, an authoritarian? That was sickening, unforgivable. How can you be civil to a man like that?
Well, it isn't all Sabu, you know. He's just a spokesman.
I know, but he loves to be the spokesman, and he's been so squalid for so long.
Well, what did you say to him? I temporized, as you might say, Shivik said, and laughed again. Takfer glanced at him again, knowing now that he was, for all his control, in a state of extreme tension or excitement.
You didn't turn him down flat, then?
I said that I'd resolved, some years ago, to accept no regular work postings, so long as I was able to do theoretical work. So he said that since it was an autonomous post, I'd be completely free to go on with the research I'd been doing. And the purpose of giving me the post was to, let's see how he put it, to facilitate access to experimental equipment at the Institute and to the regular channels of publication and dissemination. The PDC press, in other words.
Why, then, you've won,
Tocqueville said, looking at him with a queer expression.
You've won. They'll print what you write. It's what you wanted when we came back here 5 years ago. The walls are down.
There are walls behind the walls, Bedapp said.
I've won only if I accept the posting. Subul is offering to legalize me, to make me official, in order to dissociate me from the Syndicate of Initiative. Don't you see that as his motive, Dap?
Of course, Dap said. His face was somber. Divide to weaken.
But to take Shev back into the Institute and print what he writes on the PDC press is to give implied approval to the whole syndicate, isn't it?
It might mean that to most people, Shevik said.
No, it won't, Bedapp said.
It'll be explained the great physicist was misled by a disaffected group for a while. Intellectuals are always being led astray because they think about irrelevant things like time and space and reality, things that have nothing to do with real life. So they are easily fooled by wicked deviationists. But the good Odonians at the Institute gently showed him his errors, and he has returned to the path of social organic truth, leaving the Syndicate of Initiative shorn of its one conceivable claim to the attention of anybody on Anaris or Urus.
I'm not leaving the Syndicate, Bedapp.
Bedapp lifted his head and said after a minute,
No, I know you're not.
All right, let's go to dinner. This belly growls. Listen to it, Pillin. Hear it? Roar! Roar!
Hop! Pillin said in a tone of command. Shevik picked her up and stood up, swinging her onto his shoulder. Behind his head and the child's, the single mobile hanging in this room oscillated slightly. It was a large piece made of wires, pounded flat, so that, edge-on, they all but disappeared, making the ovals into which they were fashioned flicker at intervals, vanishing, as did, in certain lights, the two thin, clear bubbles of glass that moved with the oval wires in completely interwoven, ellipsoid orbits about the common center, never quite meeting, never entirely parting. Tocqueville called it the inhabitation of time. They went to the Pikesh Commons and waited till the registry board showed a sign out so they could bring Bedapp in as a guest. His registering there signed him out of the commons where he usually ate, as the system was coordinated citywide by a computer. It was one of the highly mechanized homeostatic processes beloved by the early settlers, which persisted only in Abenai. Like the less elaborate arrangements used elsewhere, it never quite worked out. There were shortages, surpluses, and frustrations, but not major ones. Signouts at Pikesh Commons were infrequent, as the kitchen was the best known in Abenai, having a tradition of great cooks. An opening appeared at last, and they went in. Two young people, whom Bedapp knew slightly as dom neighbors of Shevik's and Tokvir's, joined them at table. Otherwise, they were let alone. Left alone. Which? It did not seem to matter. They had a good dinner, a good time talking. But every now and then, Bedapp felt that around them, there was a circle of silence.
I don't know what the Arasti will think up next, he said. And though he was speaking lightly, he found himself, to his annoyance, lowering his voice. They've asked to come here, and asked Shev to come there. What will the next move be?
I didn't know they'd actually asked Shev to go there, Tocqueville said with a half frown.
Yes, you did, Shevik said. When they told me that they'd given me the prize, you know, the Seo Owen, they asked if I couldn't come, remember? To get the money that goes with it.
Shevik smiled, luminous. If there was a circle of silence around him, it was no bother to him. He had always been alone.
That's right. I did know that. It just didn't register as an actual possibility. You'd been talking for decades about suggesting in PDC that somebody might go to Urus just to shock them.
That's what we finally did this afternoon, Dap made me say it. Were they shocked? Hair on end, eyes bulging. Talkfair giggled. Pillin sat in a high chair next to Shevik, exercising her teeth on a piece of holum bread, and her voice in song. Oh, Mathery Bathery, she proclaimed. Abery Abery Babber Dab. Shevik, versatile, replied in the same vein. Adult conversation proceeded without intensity and with interruptions. Badap did not mind. He had learned long ago that you took Shevik with complications or not at all. The most silent one of them all was Sadik. Badap stayed on with them for an hour after dinner in the pleasant, spacious common rooms of the domicile, and when he got up to go, offered to accompany Sadik to her school dormitory, which was on his way. At this, something happened, one of those events or signals obscure to those outside a family. All he knew was that Shevik, with no fuss or discussion, was coming along. Talkfair had to go feed Pillin, who was getting louder and louder. She kissed Badap, and he and Shevik set off with Sadik, talking. They talked hard and walked right past the learning center. They turned back. Sadik had stopped before the dormitory entrance. She stood motionless, erect and slight, her face still, in the weak light of the street lamp. Shevik stood equally still for a moment, then went to her. What is wrong, Sadik? The child said, Shevik, may I stay in the room tonight? Of course, but what's wrong? Sadik's delicate, long face quivered and seemed to fragment. They don't like me in the dormitory, she said, her voice becoming shrill with tension, but even softer than before. They don't like you? What do you mean? They did not touch each other yet. She answered him with desperate courage. Because they don't like the syndicate, and Badap, and you. They call the big sister in the dorm room. She said we were traitors. And saying the word, the child jerked as if she had been shot, and Shevik caught her and held her. She held to him with all her strength, weeping in great gasping sobs. She was too old, too tall for him to pick up. He stood holding her, stroking her hair. He looked over her dark head at Badap. His own eyes were full of tears. He said, It's all right, Dap. Go on. There was nothing for Badap to do but leave them there, the man and the child, in that one intimacy which he could not share, the hardest and deepest, the intimacy of pain. It gave him no sense of relief or escape to go. Rather, he felt useless, diminished. I am 39 years old, he thought as he walked on towards his domicile, the five-man room where he lived in perfect independence. 40 in a few decades. What have I done? What have I been doing? Nothing. Meddling in other people's lives because I don't have one. I never took the time. And the time's going to run out on me all at once, and I will never have had that. He looked back, down the long, quiet street, where the corner lamps made soft pools of light in the windy darkness. But he had gone too far to see the father and daughter. Or they had gone. And what he meant by that, he could not have said, good as he was with words. Yet he felt that he understood it clearly, that all his hope was in the understanding, and that if he would be saved, he must change his life. When Sadik was calm enough to let go of him, Shevik left her sitting on the front step of the dormitory and went in to tell the vigil keeper that she would be staying with the parents this night. The vigil keeper spoke coldly to him. Adults who worked in children's dormitories had a natural tendency to disapprove of overnight dom visits, finding them disruptive. Shevik told himself he was probably mistaken in feeling anything more than such disapproval in the vigil keeper. The halls of the learning center were brightly lit, ringing with noise, music practice, children's voices. There were all the old sounds, the smells, the shadows, the echoes of childhood which Shevik remembered, and with him, the fears. One forgets the fears. He came out and walked home with Sadik, his arms around her thin shoulders. She was silent, still struggling. She said abruptly as they came to their entry in the Pekesh main domicile, "I know it isn't agreeable for you and Takvir to have me overnight." "Where did you get that idea?" "Because you want privacy. Adult couples need privacy." "There's Pillin," he observed. "Pillin doesn't count." "Neither do you." She sniffled, attempting to smile. When they came into the light of the room, however, her white, red-patched, puffy face at once startled Takvir into saying, "Whatever is wrong?" And Pillin, interrupted in sucking, startled out of bliss, began to howl, at which Sadik broke down again. And for a while it appeared that everyone was crying and comforting each other and refusing comfort. This sorted out quite suddenly into silence. Pillin on the mother's lap, Sadik on the father's. When the baby was replete and put down to sleep, Takvir said in a low but impassioned voice, "Now, what is it?" Sadik had gone half to sleep herself, her head on Shevik's chest. He could feel her gather herself to answer. He stroked her hair to keep her quiet and answered for her. "Some people at the learning center disapprove of us."
"And by damn, what damned right have they to disapprove of us?"
"Of the syndicate."
"Oh,"
Takvir said, a queer guttural noise, and in buttoning up her tunic, she tore the button right off the fabric. She stood looking down at it on her palm. Then she looked at Shevik and Sadik.
"How long has this been going on?"
"A long time,"
Sadik said, not lifting her head.
"Days? Decades? All quarter?"
"Oh, longer. But they're meaner in the dorm now. At night, Terzol doesn't stop them."
Sadik spoke rather like a sleep talker, and quite serenely, as if the matter no longer concerned her.
"What do they do?"
Takvir asked, though Shevik's gaze warned her.
"Well, they're just mean. They keep me out of the games and things. Tip, you know, she was a friend. She used to come and talk at least after lights out, but she stopped. Terzol is the big sister in the dorm now, and she says, Shevik,
he broke in, feeling the tension rise in the child's body, the cowering and the summoning of courage unendurable. "She says Shevik is a traitor, Sadik is an egoizer. You know what she says, Takvir." His eyes were blazing. Takvir came forward and touched her daughter's cheek, once, rather timidly. She said in a quiet voice,
"Yes, I know,"
and went and sat down on the other bed platform, facing them. The baby, tucked away next to the wall, snored slightly. People in the next room came back from commons. A door slammed. Somebody down in the square called good night and was answered from an open window. The big domicile, 200 rooms, was astir, alive, quietly, all around them. As their existence entered into its existence, so did its existence enter into theirs, as part of a whole. Presently, Sadik slipped off her father's knees and sat on the platform beside him, close to him. Her dark hair was rumpled and tangled, hanging around her face.
"I didn't want to tell you because,"
her voice sounded thin and small,
"but it just keeps getting worse. They make each other meaner."
"Then you won't go back there," Shevik said. He put his arm around her, but she resisted, sitting straight.
"If I go and talk to them," said Takvir,
"it's no use. They feel as they feel."
"But what is this we're up against?" Takvir asked with bewilderment.
Shevik did not answer. He kept his arm around Sadik, and she yielded at last, leaning her head against his arm with a weary heaviness. "There are other learning centers," he said at last, without much certainty. Takvir stood up. She clearly could not sit still and wanted to do something, to act. But there was not much to do.
Let me braid your hair, Sadik, she said in a subdued voice. She brushed and braided the child's hair. They set the screen across the room and tucked Sadik in beside the sleeping baby. Sadik was near tears again, saying goodnight, but within half an hour, they heard by her breathing that she was asleep. Shevik had settled down at the head of their bed platform with a notebook and the slate he used for calculating.
I paged that manuscript today, Takfer said.
What did it come to?
41 pages, with the supplement.
He nodded. Takfer got up, looked over the screen at the two sleeping children, returned, and sat down on the edge of the platform.
I knew there was something wrong, but she didn't say anything. She never has. She's stoical.
It didn't occur to me it was this. I thought it was just our problem. It didn't occur to me they'd take it out on children. She spoke softly and bitterly.
It grows. It keeps growing.
Will another school be any different? I don't know. If she spends much time with us, probably not.
You certainly aren't suggesting. No, I'm not. I'm stating a fact only.
If we choose to give the child the intensity of individual love, we can't spare her what comes with that, the risk of pain.
Pain from us and through us. It isn't fair she should be tormented for what we do. She's so good and good-natured. She's like clear water.
Takvir stopped, strangled by a brief rush of tears, wiped her eyes, set her lips. It isn't what we do. It's what I do. He put his notebook down. You've been suffering for it, too.
I don't care what they think.
At work?
I can take another posting?
Not here. Not in your own field.
Well, do you want me to go somewhere else? The Saruba Fishery Labs at Peace and Plenty would take me on. But where does that leave you?
She looked at him angrily.
Here, I suppose.
I could come with you. Scovan and the others are coming along in Iotic. They'll be able to handle the radio, and that's my main practical function in the Syndicate now. I can do physics as well in Peace and Plenty as I can here. But unless I drop right out of the Syndicate of Initiative, that doesn't solve the problem, does it?
I'm the problem.
I'm the one who makes trouble.
Would they care about that in a little place like Peace and Plenty?
I'm afraid they might.
Shev, how much of this hatred have you run up against? Have you been keeping quiet, like Sadik?
And like you? Well, at times. When I went to Concord last summer, it was a little worse than I told you. Rock throwing and a good-sized fight. The students who asked me to come had to fight for me. They did, too. But I got out quick. I was putting them in danger. Well, students want some danger. And after all, we've asked for a fight. We've deliberately roused people, and there are plenty on our side. But
I'm beginning to wonder if I'm not imperiling you and the children, Zack, by staying with you.
Of course you're not in danger yourself, she said savagely.
I've asked for it, but it didn't occur to me they'd extend their tribal resentment to you.
I don't feel the same about your danger as I do about mine.
Altruist? Maybe.
I can't help it. I do feel responsible, Zack.
Without me, you could go anywhere, or stay here. You've worked for the Syndicate, but what they hold against you is your loyalty to me. I'm the symbol. So there isn't anywhere for me to go.
Go to Urus, Takfer said. Her voice was so harsh that Shevik sat back, as if she had hit him in the face. She did not meet his eyes, but she repeated, more softly,
Go to Urus. Why not? They want you there.
They don't hear.
Maybe they'll begin to see what they've lost when you're gone. And you want to go? I saw that tonight. I never thought of it before, but when we talked about the prize at dinner, I saw it, the way you laughed.
I don't need prizes and rewards.
No? But you do need appreciation, and discussion, and students, with no Sabul strings attached. And look,
You and Depp keep talking about scaring PDC with the idea of somebody going to Urus, asserting his right to self-determination. But if you talk about it and nobody goes, you've only strengthened their side. You've only proved that custom is unbreakable. Now you've brought it up in a PDC meeting. Somebody will have to go. It ought to be you. They've asked you. You have a reason to go. Go get your reward. The money they're saving for you. She ended with a sudden, quite genuine laugh. Takvir, I don't want to go to Urus. Yes, you do. You know you do. Though I'm not sure I know why.
Well, of course I'd like to meet some of the physicists. And see the laboratories at AUN, where they've been experimenting with light. He looked shamefaced as he said it.
It's your right to do so, Takvir said with fierce determination. If it's part of your work, you ought to do it.
It would help keep the revolution alive, on both sides, wouldn't it? He said. What a crazy idea. Like Tyrion's play, only backwards. I'm to go subvert the archists. Well, it would at least prove to them that Anaris exists. They talk with us on the radio, but I don't think they really believe in us, in what we are.
If they did, they might be scared. They might come and blow us right out of the sky, if you really convince them. I don't think so. I might make a little revolution in their physics again, but not in their opinions. It's here that I can affect society, even though here they won't pay attention to my physics. You're quite right. Now that we've talked about it, we must do it. There was a pause. He said, I wonder what kind of physics the other races do.
What other races?
The aliens. People from Hain and other solar systems. There are two alien embassies on Urus, Hain and Terra. The Hainish invented the interstellar drive Urus uses now. I suppose they'd give it to us too, if we were willing to ask for it. It would be interesting to... He did not finish. After another long pause, he turned to her and said in a changed, sarcastic tone, And what would you do while I went visiting the proper Terrians?
Go to the Saruba coast with the girls and live a very peaceful life as a fish lab technician until you come back.
Come back. Who knows if I could come back? She met his gaze straight on.
What would prevent you?
Maybe the Erasti. They might keep me. No one there is free to come and go, you know. Maybe our own people. They might prevent me from landing. Some of them in PDC threatened that today. Rulag was one of them.
She would. She only knows denial, how to deny the possibility of coming home.
That is quite true. That says it completely, he said, settling back again and looking at Takvir with contemplative admiration. But Rulag isn't the only one, unfortunately. To a great many people, anyone who went to Urus and tried to come back would simply be a traitor, a spy.
What would they actually do about it?
Well, if they persuaded Defense of the danger, they could shoot down the ship.
Would Defense be that stupid?
I don't think so. But anybody outside Defense could make explosives with blasting powder and blow up the ship on the ground. Or more likely, attack me once I was outside the ship. I think that's a definite possibility. It should be included in a plan to make a round-trip tour of the scenic areas of Urus.
Would it be worthwhile to you, that risk?
He looked forward at nothing for a time.
Yes. He said,
in a way, if I could finish the theory there and give it to them, to us and them and all the worlds, you know, I'd like that. Here I'm walled in, I'm cramped, it's hard to work, to test the work, always without equipment, without colleagues and students, and then when I do the work, they don't want it. Or if they do, like Sabu, they want me to abandon initiative in return for receiving approval. They'll use the work I do after I'm dead. That always happens. But why must I give my life work as a present to Sabul all the Sobbles, the petty, scheming, greedy egos of one single planet. I'd like to share it. It's a big subject I work on. It ought to be given out, handed around. It won't run out. All right, then, Takfair said. It is worth it. Worth what? The risk. Perhaps not being able to come back. Not being able to come back, he repeated. He looked at Takfair with a strange, intense, yet abstracted gaze. I think there are more people on our side, on the syndicate's side, than we realize. It's just that we haven't actually done much, done anything to bring them together, taken any risk. If you took it, I think they'd come out in support of you. If you opened the door, they'd smell fresh air again. They'd smell freedom.
And they might all come rushing to slam the door shut.
If they do, too bad for them. The syndicate can protect you when you land. And then, if people are still so hostile and hateful, we'll say, the hell with them. What's the good of an anarchist society that's afraid of anarchists? We'll go live in Lonesome, in Upper Sedep, in Uttermost. We'll go live alone in the mountains if we have to. There's room. There'd be people who'd come with us. We'll make a new community. If our society is settling down into politics and power-seeking, then we'll get out. We'll go make an Inaris beyond Inaris, a new beginning. How's that?
Beautiful, he said. It's beautiful, dear heart. But I'm not going to go to Urz, you know.
Oh, yes. And you will come back, Takfair said. Her eyes were very dark, a soft darkness, like the darkness of a forest at night. If you set out to, you always get to where you're going, and you always come back.
Don't be stupid, Takfair. I'm not going to Urz.
I'm worn out, Takfair said, stretching and leaning over to put her forehead against his arm. Let's go to bed.